back to Monday Night Talk.
All right, we are back. Again, we want to thank Brenda, Paul, and Liz for being a part of that segment. We turn our focus to, well, who could be the very next president of the United States. As we see the Republican field, there were at least at one time or another about 52 candidates. I think we're down to, what, like five or six? Well, and you had maybe four or five in regards to the Dems. Now it's down to just a lonely two. I thought I would call in somebody from around the way to see if they'd want to come on and chat with us, Jeff and Joe. And Peter, I want to say, Doctor, I want to make sure I have your name correct here, because thanks to the help from Christine James. Are you there, Peter?
I'm here.
I want to make sure I say your name correctly here, and that is Ubertasio?
That's right, Ubertasio.
Ubertasio.
You're very close, closer than most.
Okay, I'll have to keep that in mind. And you've got quite... Now, what do you prefer? You have a list of things here. You're director of... Let me see. Hold on. Associate Dean of Interdisciplinary Programs. Associate Professor of Political Science. Director of the Martin Institute for Law and Society. Is there anything else?
I occasionally do the windows as well.
Oh, okay. Good, good.
Wait, you're leaving off the political professors blog that you do,
the
right?
Mass Politics Profs blogs that I do with a number of my colleagues.
God bless you. So you've got to be loving this time of year right now, because we're going to have some state races, but kind of the big thing on the horizon, I mean, we had Super Tuesday coming up. I know that the Dems and the Republicans across in the country, you're going to have, I think the Dems are going to be in South Carolina.
They take over South Carolina, and the Republicans take over Nevada.
Yep. So that's quite the gamble. And so it's interesting to see what's happening with the presidential politics. Doctor, give me your thoughts on what we've been watching over the past couple of weeks with presidential politics.
Yeah, I mean, I think particularly on the Republican side, we're seeing something we just have not seen before. None of the standard rules of Republican Party politics are applying in this cycle. And the Republicans have, you know, for generations, typically given their nomination over to someone who's well-known within the party, who's typically run before. And in this cycle, you have this consistent level of support for Donald Trump really comes from outside the party system. His support is probably not higher than about 30-35%, but given the sheer number of candidates in the race thus far, he's been able to use that to gain some impressive victories. And it just completely upends everything we thought we knew about Republican Party nomination processes.
Well, I'm sure you've had a chance to hear everybody's different theories as to how Donald Trump can be so Teflon when it comes to certain things that he says, certain ways that he's already gotten into verbal confrontations with the Pope, some of the other individuals who are in the race, some of the things that he's said. How is he able to continuously say the things that he says and yet still be doing so well when it comes time for folks to go to the polls?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm not convinced that it will last the entire cycle if he ends up being the nominee. But I think what the folks who are supporting Trump are really taken by the fact that he's a pugnacious candidate. And they seem to not be fully digesting the major inconsistencies or even some of the outlandish things that he said. I think that with Trump, unlike any other candidate that I have seen in modern American politics, people seem to be willing to think, well, he doesn't really mean it. You know, that they like the fight in him, but they don't think he really means some of the things that he's saying. And they seem to be viewing Trump through the lens I think he has cultivated, through his, you know, celebrity lens, where we give folks a lot more leeway than we tend to do for people who are about to assume, you know, really significant power. So it's shocking the things that he's willing to say, that he seems happy to say. When he's inconsistent, he just kind of, you know, shrugs it off and doesn't really worry about it. And none of this has impacted his standing in the polls. But I should say that he hasn't really been able to grow either. He's kind of had a consistent level of support, and the thing that has really benefited him is that there have been so many other viable candidates splitting the vote.
Yeah, you know, Peter, this is Jeff. I just wanted to say, too, I think when people talk about Jeb Bush dropping out, obviously they wonder where his numbers are going to go, and I think we'll be seeing polling soon to see, you know, if that people can parse that out. I know that, you know, Donald Trump tends to be sort of more of an outsider. I think Ted Cruz is even perceived as an outsider, and Ben Carson, of course. If you kind of total their votes, you know, you potentially look at an actual majority of people supporting a somewhat outsider candidate.
Right.
And I think the interesting thing, too, up until Nevada for the Democrats was Bernie Sanders looked like he was sort of mirroring that on the Democrat side to an extent. I mean, not as well known, wasn't even a Democrat, you know, fully as in a party registration until I think a year ago. But he's come in and tapped into that same sort of sense that I think Trump and the other people have, which is that D.C. may not be listening to them and I've got a better way of doing it. It may not be specific, but I've got a better way and just trust me.
Yeah, I think that you're right. They both there's a base of support in both parties for outsider candidates or for people not part of the system. You know, Trump uses that a lot to really great effect. And I think that he's really tapped into something that has existed for a while, but there's the anger level and the frustration with affairs in Washington has grown to such a fever pitch that both candidates and both parties have been able to tap into that. I think that you're right. I mean, I think, you know, Trump benefits probably more so because he's so much more well-known. And people, you know, have heard of Donald Trump. He's been around for a long time, though not a member of the political system. Sanders had a lot of legwork to do to catch up to Hillary Clinton's lead in the polls. That he has done so and kept, you know, has either won or kept these early contests close, I think is another testament to the fact there's a real interest in outsider candidates this cycle.
Joe?
Yeah, you know what I find, Peter, what I find interesting, if you look at what just happened in South Carolina, and I was taking a look at what some people were saying about this, is you had two things happen. You had a debate where Trump attacked Bush viciously, the former President Bush, in regards to his record.
And
then you had, and exactly, yeah. And then you had the election itself where Bush was so horribly received that he ended up dropping out of the race. I read an interesting article today that actually said that regardless of what Trump may have said, that the fact that Bush did so terribly there is going to rewrite the way that the former president's record is looked upon since he was so popular in South Carolina in the past. What is your take on that?
Well, that's a great question. And I think, you know, while we've been so mesmerized by the Trump candidacy and thinking about who's up and who's down now that Bush is out, something that requires, I think, our time and attention is this important closing of this chapter in American politics, which is the end of the Bush dynasty. I am impressed by how poorly he did and how bringing in George W. Bush, who was supposed to be someone who could help right the ship for Jeb Bush in South Carolina, how it didn't have any impact whatsoever. You really get the sense that while there may be some affection for George W. Bush in South Carolina, that is probably we're thinking of the reflection of George W. Bush versus Barack Obama, who's not popular at all there. But that affection for W. did not extend at all to voting for Jeb. People were willing to hear him, and they still respect him. And I think he probably retains a degree of popularity, but it's affection. People weren't listening to him, and that's a very different thing and really important because the Bushes have typically done well there. And that tells me something else. There's something else going on in the Republican Party that we probably didn't fully appreciate until after South Carolina. If George W. Bush can't help make an impact in a state like that, I suspect we're not going to be seeing much of him on the campaign trail, no matter who the nominee is. And I do think this will impact the way that we view him historically. You know, he has benefited from the lack of popularity of Barack Obama, but this is going to impact that a bit because, you know, these were supposed to be his people, supposed to be his crowd, in a place that he's done well. And Jeb's really anemic performance there is going to have an impact on the way we view the Bush presidency.
This can put an end to that collective groan that I heard about a year or a year and a half ago when people said, oh, maybe Bush Clinton again. And I think everybody said, no way. No way.
Yeah. No. Yeah, I think too close. You know, I think, unfortunately, for Jeb Bush, you know, we're still too close in time to that presidency.
Sure.
And it was hard to imagine a year ago, except for his resources, that he would be able to pull it off. But there seemed to be a moment when, you know, it you know, early in the summer, it seemed like still a possibility. But he was unable to handle Donald Trump and then just outmaneuvered by other candidates. And really, you know, when he mentioned in debate, I can't remember which one it was, but he used the phrase, a Bush presidency. And I thought that's the problem for this candidate. You can't use that in the future tense without reminding everyone about its use in the past tense and the things they'd like or dislike about, you know, the father and the brother. And that he just was never going to be in a position to overcome that.
Again, we are speaking with Dr. Peter Ubitasio, a gentleman that we know. Anytime that I've seen the media looking for somebody to get a little insight into politics, what's going on locally, on the state level and federal level, Peter's the guy that they go to and they talk to. I want to kind of go on the other side of the coin here. I know we're kind of GOP'd up on the first part of the conversation with Peter, but I would look on the other side. We're sitting here talking about Jeb Bush and people tired of Jeb Bush. Are people also tired of the Clinton name, Doctor?
I think they are to a certain extent. It's not impacting the Democratic race as much as it is on the Republican side with Bush. I think there's still great affection for Hillary Clinton among elements of the Democratic base and within the Democratic Party. I think it's viewed a little differently when it's a spouse and a spouse as opposed to the son and brother of a president. But I think the fear for Democrats really is, does it impact the general election? Depending on who the Republican nominee is, do they present a new, fresh face? Do they go with Rubio and present a new generation of Republican leadership? And does Clinton, you know, get tagged not only with being a Clinton and member of another political dynasty, but you know, does she look like she's the older face of the Democratic establishment that people are no longer enamored by? And do they really want a third term of Barack Obama? She's got a number of issues there that could impact her going into the fall election.
And she also has issues that are going to still linger if she does end up being the Democratic nominee that she'll be attacked on, and that's Benghazi, the whole email debacle that, you know, we keep hearing over and over and over about.
Well, that's right. And I think the question for Democrats is, you know, have those issues run the course, meaning I suspect that the voters who are really passionate about those issues were never going to be Clinton was never going to be able to capture them anyway. Those are Republican voters. They're going to go with whomever the Republican nominee is. The question is really, has it impact independent voters? And the question for them, it seems to me, I think the advantage that Clinton has over a Bush is that the Clinton years are viewed more favorably among the general population, among independent voters, than the Bush years. And so I think the question for independent voters is, are they, you know, if they may agree with her on policy or if they view her husband's time as in office favorably, are they willing to overlook that and have Benghazi or the emails or issues of her trust impact their vote? And I think that we don't yet know how that's going to play out.
So, Peter, you know, being in politics myself, sometimes what's not said is just as important as what's said.
Amen.
And I think one of the things happening now is people are looking at Elizabeth Warren, a major star right here in Massachusetts in the Democratic Party.
Raised and really, some serious money, too.
Yeah, but not being willing to endorse Hillary Clinton at this point. I mean, that everybody else in the Massachusetts delegation is on board, yet she stands out. And I think that's not just here in Massachusetts. That's having an impact. It's across the country as well. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? And, you know, you're right. You put an exclamation point on that when you say every Democrat, every major Democrat in the state has not only endorsed Clinton, but has been really vocal and active. And they were all, you know, just kind of literally living in New Hampshire, and it didn't do anything for Clinton there. And we don't have a lot of good polling here, but the polls that we have show that it could be a fairly tight race. I think Elizabeth Warren's silence has given Bernie Sanders the opening that he may not have had.
Mm. Isn't that funny? The inaction of one person can still
does,
keep a
yeah.
campaign
yeah.
alive.
It resonates. Yep.
It's impressive. Well, Warren is wholly unlike your sort of average, typical senator. I mean, she is a rock star in very progressive circles across the country. And a colleague of mine wrote a column today basically saying she probably will not end up endorsing Sanders and is most likely going to endorse Clinton. But the fact that she has been silent for so long when none of her colleagues in Massachusetts have been is telling. And it wouldn't surprise me if Sanders and his people can use that silence to very great effect, particularly here in Massachusetts on Tuesday. I still think they face some structural problems elsewhere, but if they were able to keep this race close or to pull off a victory in Massachusetts on Tuesday, despite all the endorsements from all those other people, I think that's as much a testament to Warren's power as it is to Sanders.
Quick question.
Peter, you know, if you look at, let's look a second, if you take the two candidates or the candidates on each side and you put them head to head for a second, if you look at Clinton and you look at, you know, the various Republicans.
How they match up.
It looks to me, and I just saw these numbers today, it looks like the only two that come anywhere close are Trump and Kasich. Kasich's, the poll comes out that says he'd actually beat her right now by 1 or 2 points. Trump's only behind 1 or 2. What does that say, too, about, you know, I know the other, Rubio and Cruz are the other two I looked at. They're behind by about 5 or 6 points head-to-head to Clinton, and I didn't get the chance to look at Sanders' numbers. You know, what is that? I know it's early, and I know it's hard to do these hypotheticals, but, you know, what does that say also about, you know, what, I know the process to elect somebody within a party is different than the general election, but what does that say about what's coming down the road?
Yeah, it's a really good point, and important to remember that you know, we're in an inter-party process right now. Yep. And that the dynamics are very different, and so. But having said that, you know, yeah, I mean, I think the early poll, you have to take them with a lot of salt, these early polls. But it does seem to me that Kasich is going to attempt to use this to very great effect over the next few weeks. You know, polls showing him, who's not quite as well known, to be sure, as Donald Trump, but is able to, you know, demonstrate some strength in the polls as the kind of candidate that could potentially beat Hillary Clinton. I don't know that will be enough, because he's speaking, as you point out, to a very specific kind of audience, and not one that's probably listening to that. But I think that an early poll showing Donald Trump keeping it close with Hillary Clinton is not really an early poll on the issues, and it's really testing some other things. And I'd be surprised if a man who can only pull in 30%, who can't grow, you know, has got 70% of the people unsure of his candidacy, is able to, would be able to pull off a victory like that in the fall.
Paul, last question I'll ask you.
Peter,
I'm sorry.
Stealing from Paul.
No, because our next guest is Paul, and I have that on the mind. Paul, we got Paul Craney, who's going to be coming up next, and it's my apology. Peter, last question I will ask you, and that will be looking ahead to next Tuesday. What are you going to be watching for as somebody who follows numbers and trends? What are you going to be watching for in regards to both the Republicans and Democrats?
Well, specifically here in Massachusetts, I'm looking at those kind of purple areas in Worcester County, Bristol County, and Plymouth and Barnstable County to see what the turnout is like and to see what the breakdown is. That has implications not only for who's going to win, but there's some really competitive races for the state party that, if they go one way or another, could have implications for the governor and his relationship to his own party going into his reelection. So I think that's going to be those down ballot races for rather obscure positions are going to take on some heightened importance next week. But I'm looking, you know, to see, does Trump, across the country, does Trump stay at basically 30%, 30 to 32%, and can any of the other candidates come close enough to that to start actually winning? You know, Marco Rubio, who's trumpeted now as the person the establishment is rallying behind, hasn't won anywhere. And there's not a lot of time to put it together. And if Trump comes out of that with a number of handy victories, I don't see how you stop him. You know, I just think the momentum is completely going to be on his side.
I saw a poll today from Emerson saying Trump had 50% in Massachusetts. And I thought, I mean, of any state that would rally around Rubio, this would be the state. And yet it looks like it's
and that's without the governor endorsing him.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's right. The governor has endorsed him. It's really impressive when you consider a first-time candidate. I mean, he has advantages that most first-time candidates don't have.
Sure.
But, I would think that someone like John Kasich or Marco Rubio could do well in Massachusetts. They don't seem to be breaking through.
Peter, we want to thank you so much for joining us, and I would love to have you back on in a couple of weeks just to kind of see how things have changed with both parties and any more candidates that might have fallen by the wayside, if that's okay.
I'd be delighted. It's always nice to talk about these issues.
Excellent. There he is, Dr. Peter Ubitasio. He is with Stonehill College, serving in many different capacities, joining us here on Monday night. And what we-